Hello and welcome to pod 50 of the official Palace pod. I'm Chris Grierson from Palace TV, which you can watch on YouTube on our official club app, on Palace TV, which is at eagles.cpfc.co.uk, and on all our social media channels. I hope you've enjoyed everything that we've put out recently. We've obviously had the Instagram live interviews with players and also the 1861 documentary recently. If you haven't seen that, then please do watch it. We spent quite a while putting that together, actually. I think we did the first bits of filming back in October, and then every month or two we'd put a little bit of the puzzle together until it all came together right at the end. And actually the last bit we filmed was the bit at Lourdes, which was the day, I think it was the day before we were officially put in lockdown. The last day we were able to do it, we managed to get into the long room at Lourdes, which was pretty exciting. So do watch that if you get the chance. But this podcast is from a chat I did with Terry Byfield, who has worked at the club since 1984 in every single role. It was around the anniversary of the 1990 FA Cup semi-final against Liverpool. Oh, and if you're listening to this like soon after it comes out, the full 120 minutes of that is still on Palace TV and YouTube at the moment. It's probably going to be taken down in the next month or two because there's special rules during lockdown about using FA Cup footage. So we've taken advantage of that. So do go and watch that if you haven't already. But this is a really, really interesting chat that I had with Terry about his career at the club, but mainly about that 1990 FA Cup run and what it was like for a member of staff at the club having to plan it all. So here is Terry. Right, we're rolling. Terry, I've just watched the highlights of the 1990 FA Cup semi-final. Obviously, you were at the club then, 30 years ago. But before we talk about that, so you'd been at the club about 6 years before that, hadn't you, 1984. What roles had you had at the club before then?
So I started in 84 on reception, answering all the queries, telling people that ticket details and games are postponed, when they were and that kind of thing, answering general inquiries, and then went into the box office for a short time, then went into setting up the publications department with Pete King, and then probably about 1988, I moved to the role of assistant club secretary to then club secretary Mike Hurst.
So assistant club secretary, but back in those days, how big a job was it?
Yeah, so obviously in sort of that period of time, so we just got promotion in 89 going into the sort of cup final time, but obviously it was a very small staff-wise. There was the lottery office and club shop and box office down near next to Sainsbury's area. And then we were based in the offices opposite Crystal's, and there was about six or seven of us, including the including receptionist and sort of sales and marketing, accounts, club secretary, myself, the chairman and his PA and the manager. So it was a very much smaller sort of staff system to what football clubs know these days.
And the players used to come into the offices in the afternoon sometimes, didn't they?
Yeah, so in that time they were training over at Mitcham, at the base now in Bishopsford Road, where Tooting & Mitcham's stadium is. And they'd train there sort of from about 10 o'clock through until about half one, two. And then you get a certain amount of them that would over in the afternoon, they'd come over to do sort of different commercial work with the lottery office, sort of publicity, taking photos, or come over and see us in the publications department and do interviews for Club Call. Or if we wanted programme interviews, then more often than not, we would grab them while they're at the stadium. And obviously, it was a good opportunity to get any pictures of them away from match day. We wanted pictures of them at Sellers Park or etc. So, yeah, they'd come over in the afternoon.
And was it Geoff Thomas that used to drop like lunch off for people? I'm sure I heard Joanne.
Yeah, so Geoff Thomas and John Pemberton. They used to come over quite a bit. And obviously at those times, we had a fish and chip shop downstairs. So they would sometimes go in there and get fish and chips for the office staff. And so we'd go up to the lottery office and see them and come into our office as well quite a bit. And, you know, there was quite a number, to be fair, that would come over and see us.
Did you get a lot more staff when you got promoted in 89?
Or was it
Probably the marketing, the sales and marketing department probably expanded, obviously a little bit more. The lottery office moved from behind where the club shop and box office used to be, moved up to where the main offices are now. It was formerly the study centre. So they were two departments that certainly expanded. And the shop and box office continued to be twin. It was probably sort of a lot further on before, you know, before numbers increased to what we're used to nowadays.
Yeah, because I mean, even when I started, however long that, 5.5 years ago, we're about four times the size now in our department, aren't we?
Yeah, so we would have, for example, in publications department, there was myself, Pete King, and a couple of others who would come in part-time. And then in the club secretary side, there'd be myself and Mike Hurst, and the accounts department would probably be Mike doing some of the work in there, and Doug Miller, who was the financial controller. So it was a lot. It's quite hard to explain, but all the work sort of got done, but it was on a much smaller numbers staff-wise.
So that season, earlier on, you had the 9-0 game up at Anfield. Did you go to that? Did you go to every game as assistant press club secretary?
I went up as a fan. I used to go up on Coach 3, one of the supporters' coaches. So I used to go up to the away games then. I did go up to that match on the Tuesday night at Anfield. Saw us lose 9-0, and probably was obviously a major reason why the victory, the appetite for the game at Villa Park meant so much to Palace fans at the time.
How good were Liverpool then, back then?
They were very, very good, and I think there was that particular night, obviously, we were unlucky to meet them in that kind of form. But they played us off the park, obviously. And there was always a story that Steve Coppell tells that when Geoff Thomas had the penalty, if that went in, he says that the management bench were going to run on the pitch in celebration. Of course, that wasn't needed, but it was a night, obviously a very disappointing night and a very upsetting night for the club. But as far as to see Liverpool in that kind of form in that era, they were very good.
And then you had the cup run. The FA Cup, a lot of younger people probably won't realise how special the FA Cup. It used to be a lot more of an event, didn't it? Like every single round. I mean, especially Cup Final Day. I remember
seeing... Yeah, I mean, the Cup Final Day certainly was. And that was mainly because there was very little football on. You'd occasionally have some international games live on a Wednesday night from Wembley Stadium, and some European games, the latter stages of European games. But FA Cup Final Day, for somebody of my age group, was, you know, we would literally the whole day from 9 in the morning with Cup Final breakfast on both BBC and ITV would be taken up through the whole build-up of the day. Cameras on the team coach with the teams going to Wembley, you know, and then different individual programmes that viewers would know that were on at that time, sort of made, but with a cup final theme. So, it certainly was. Each round was, you wanted to get through. There wasn't so much where nowadays people sort of say, oh, we don't want to, you know, take away from our league form. The FA Cup was very much around its own competition and getting to the as far as you could.
And did you want a home tie or an away tie when it came to the draw in the FA Cup back then? I know a lot of the time people want an away one to go somewhere different, but what was the feeling back then?
Yeah, I think for your programme editor, you want an away tie, so you haven't got an extra programme to do, and there's some fans who obviously like to go to as many grounds as they can, and also like the appetite of having to go to a new ground, so that was always a good opportunity. Obviously with us in that year, we got a few home draws, didn't we? Portsmouth, Huddersfield and Rochdale. So it was three straight out the hat. But even talking about the appetite for the FA Cup, that used to be an exciting thing because the cup draw used to be done on a Monday lunchtime at 12:30 on what was Five Live, was called in those days Radio 2. And they literally used to pull the numbers out of little balls out of a velvet bag. And we'd all sit in the office waiting for the cup draw. And it would come in at 12:30 and you'd literally in the office sit and hear who you've got. So that was sort of part of your working day. And then depending on who you've got, and if you've got a home draw, then you started work on preparing for that game straight away.
So, yeah, what kind of work did that involve back then, as soon as the draw happened? What was the first thing you had to do?
So you'd get in touch with the opponents, with the opponent's club secretary or assistant club secretary, and organise the actual date of when the game's going to be played, which is normally the Saturday. There wasn't so many games chosen for TV in that day. Organise the ticket allocations, whether it was us going away or Portsmouth, for example, in that year, third round coming to us. Organise the ticket allocation and then let the fans know of what the ticket prices were going to be. And obviously, even something like that in those days, we had Club Call, which was a telephone information service, and we had the Croydon Advertiser. And they really were our two areas, two forms of communication to let fans know, we've drawn Portsmouth, the ticket prices are such and such, and they're going to go on sale on Thursday. So it was the talk of to get the information out there. And as I touched on earlier, because there wasn't so many staff, you'd normally, as assistant secretary, be getting that work message out to the Croydon Advertiser in that time.
Club Call, was that the thing that they used to advertise on teletext?
Yeah, so that was an 0891, 0898 numbers, where clubs would, we would, like what we touched on earlier, with players coming to the ground. We would, when we did see a player, whether it was there or at the training ground, we would get interviews and they'd be reflecting on the previous game and looking ahead to the next game. So all clubs would use their Club Call service as a source of revenue and also to put the messages out there. So you'd have a little section of news at the top of the programme, then you'd have an interview and then a recap on any club news at the end of the interview. And myself and Pete launched that at Palace when we set up the Palace publications department. And it ran for a number of years, and we were one of the most called in the country. There was a lot of clubs who really got into it. It was obviously match day. We had live commentary, and we had a manager on after the game or a player being interviewed. And one month, we ran this thing where every Sunday morning, we had a manager, Steve Coppell, or a player would come in and take calls live and answer questions about the games the day before. For about 2 hours on a Sunday morning in the offices of Palace, which obviously in those days was great because they didn't get to hear as much as they do now about what the manager thinks of the game.
It's amazing. It's almost like, apart from that, it's almost like all the same kind of things that are done now, but we're just using different means of doing it, because that some of the Club Call stuff just sounds like a podcast would be now. And then the post-match interviews is what we put on the club website now as video.
Yeah, and also, obviously, it's much better now for the club to have more forms of communication to get the message out. But there were just obviously different things. In those days, we also still had the programme. I think in those days, there probably were 32 pages when we first started the department, and went up to about 64 when I finished doing the programme. So, that was something that was a lot different, because obviously now the programme gets sent away electronically, but in those days we used to have to send the copy by motorbike in individual envelopes of all the pages and the photos, separate envelopes for what page it was going on, and then out of that we'd get faxes back with the proofs, and we'd have to read the proofs, which obviously meant that sometimes some errors slipped in, but those who used to spot those errors will now know why they did, because we were proofreading it on a fax machine.
Well, yeah. So the people making errors nowadays, but no excuse, have they?
No excuse at all. Well, there aren't any, are there? Surely. Just ask Dan Blazer.
Right, going back to the 1990s, so the semi-final draw, can you remember it?
Yeah, so we had beaten Cambridge United. Jeff Thomas obviously scored at the Abbey Stadium on the Saturday afternoon. That got quite a... because it was a quarter-final game, so that night, match of the day, covered that. John Motson did the commentary for that game. And we were packed behind the goal, all the fans, at one end behind the goal at the Abbey Stadium. And then we got through that. And obviously then you think, right, who are we going to get? Who could be, Man United, Liverpool or Oldham? And we sat in the office that lunchtime and we found out that we'd got Liverpool. And immediately you think back to what had happened at Anfield earlier in the season. But I think because it was the FA Cup and it was a one-off game, I think there was always that sort of thought that, you know, it could be our day. It's a one-off. You never know what's going to happen. And it was certainly an exciting time around the club building up to it, with all the red and blue balloons and the anticipation of the day, etc. And the tickets all coming in, you know, to sell. It was certainly, I wouldn't look back on it and say you sort of remember dread of having to play them. I think there was great optimism at that time that we could pull something off.
So, and what was the first thing you did once it had been announced it was Liverpool at Villa Park?
So we had literally the tickets allocation had to be decided. So it was literally the stadium was just split up. I think we obviously had the Holt end for standing fans, and then the main stand, the Trinity Road stand, was given to our fans as well. And the prices in that time, I think it was something like £7 to stand on the Holt end, and something like three different categories of prices, might be like 12, 14, 16, to have seats in the main stand, where the dugout was. So we organised the ticket allocation then when they were going on sale, and then the anticipation of the fans to queue up and get the fans. And it's very difficult because obviously, as nowadays really, when you have those big games, you have to make sure that you're servicing the season ticket holders, the members, those that go to regular to away games, you know, all that has still, even in 1990, all that has to be thought of and make sure that you tick all the boxes for the fans. So that was good. So we did that. And then we had the tickets all go on sale. They obviously went on sale and were taken in no time. And then as the match got nearer, we had things like, we had a press conference day. And going back to things like we do now, but I can assure you that it was a lot smaller affair than the press conference we have now. And I've dug out actually the facts that I actually sent to the press association and the Exchange Telegraph, which was like what Wardour's press agency is now, and that was actually sent out by myself to them, notifying that the press day for the Liverpool game was going to be Thursday, the 5th of April. At Beckenham Training Ground, 10:30 to 11:30, and I was as threatening in those days, Chris, that you find me now, because I finished it with that interviews with players will only be this day and it will not be given at any other time, and so that's that, and I've still got the actual fax receipt for it as well. So that's all good stuff. That's one obviously for the book when it comes out. But so that press conference day, in those days, it was. It was things like, it would have been more so written press. So it would have been the Croydon Advertiser, South London Press. And as far as TV were concerned, I think Sky in those days were still called BSB, British Sky Broadcasting. So they would have been there. And also the local TV may well have been still in those days, Thames TV and BBC local TV as well. So, but it wasn't the kind of thing nowadays where, you know, they ring up and they say they want to interview Steve Coppell or they want this player, that player. We basically did it, but all the players were there after training for an hour and you could come down and interview them. And it was a fairly relaxed affair. But that was a Thursday before the Sunday. So obviously at that time, for fans, players, management and everything, it was all beginning to hot up at that time.
I've interviewed quite a lot of players from that team and from that era. They all seem to be really good talkers. Were they a particularly good group of players?
Yeah, they were. And they all talk, when you do interview them about that era, they do all mention the spirit, the character in the dressing room, the togetherness. And you could see that. They all defended one another. If there was a game where somebody made a mistake or had a, you know, disappointing game that maybe let the side down, or somebody did well at the other end of the scale, everyone was behind each other and made sure that everyone, you know, got praised. And it was a big team effort. And we were fortunate. I mean, obviously, as I say, the media profile wasn't, or the demands for the media wasn't so much as it is nowadays. But we did have some good talkers in that squad, your likes of Mark and Ian, Jeff Thomas, John Pemberton, Nigel Martin. They all did a large number of media interviews with the local papers and with TV when needed. So I think it was a good group. And I think that's why, obviously, 89, we just got through, got promotion. So that group was sort of carried through, continued the success, and ended up in the semi-final of the FA Cup the following season. So I think it, the club, the playing squad, they were very much on a crest of a wave.
And when it came to booking accommodation for them playing in the Midlands, what did you go for?
So in those days, how it used to work was that you used to I used to speak to Steve Coppell. He had his particular hotels around the country that he'd like the teams to stay at, depending on the away game. And he went for a hotel, the Newhall Hotel, which is in Sutton Coldfield. And the way that worked is that you get in touch. Steve's made the choice of where they want to stay. You then get in touch with the hotel and you'd explain when they'd be arriving, what their requirements are while they're there. And then they're there on the Saturday afternoon, because it was a Sunday midday kickoff, and then they left for the game to at Villa Park. And you'll be pleased to know that I've got another bit of paper here. And this is actually the requirement of what was sent to Newhall Hotel, of their requirement for when they arrived. So they basically got there on the Saturday lunchtime and had fish and chips for the whole party. And then on the Sunday they had, and then Saturday night they had the evening meal included in the main course for them to choose from, were a variety of things like fillet steak, Dover sole, roast chicken, pasta main course. You'd imagine that was probably Brighty's first choice, I would think. And then they had a suite with sweets to choose from. And then because it was a midday kickoff, there was no sort of pre-match meal. Their meal was the full English breakfast on Sunday morning. So the routine really, as far as booking the hotel, was, even though it was the FA Cup semi-final, was the same as it was for a normal league game. So they stayed at the Newhall Hotel, obviously a very nice hotel, and they went up there. And in the week leading up to the game, we also found out that we were going to be wearing the home kit, and we also got, I think it must have been a toss of a coin, but we won the toss of the coin to decide that we would be in the home dressing room as well. So two little things that for footballers, who obviously a lot of it's about superstition, two good things that the fans going there will see us in our red and blue, and also for the players that we'd be in the home dressing room at Villa Park.
I think there's a story behind the fish and chips, isn't there? Because we're on the 2016 run to the final, Pardew made our squad eat fish and chips at the training ground before every FA Cup game, the day before.
Yeah, so that was probably carried on, as you say. So they've had that on the Saturday for the Sunday semi-final, so it does sound as though it was something maybe that they did each day, or each Friday before the round, or maybe as the round built on and they got further on in the competition. And then on the day itself, there was a couple of coaches. There was a player's wife's coach that took the players' wives up from Mitcham, and a coach that took the players' families up from Mitcham. And I think a lot of the cellar staff went on a coach, and some of us went with the fans on the away travel coaches. And then we got up there, and it was, as many of you will have seen, if you weren't there on the day, was a sea of red and blue. And it was a tremendous atmosphere. And it was just, you know, I think the fans that were able to get tickets for the game went up there fearing because of what had happened in the 9-0, and particularly then when Ian Rush gave us the lead. But obviously, as they say, the rest is history. And it was a tremendous occasion for anyone, you know, attached to Palace, whether then, past, present. And also, I think the other thing is that when you mentioned in conversation with them, what's your favourite Palace game? Even though we went on and then lost the final, I think this probably would be not only everyone's favourite Palace game, but probably everyone's one of the best FA Cup matches over the years.
Yeah, definitely. And so there were about 16,000 Palace fans there, weren't there? I saw John Motson mentions on the commentary that we only sold 16,000 out of the 18,000 because they went to members only.
Yeah, so that was what I touched on earlier about the allocation and making sure that everyone who had followed the club through the season was able to have an opportunity to get one. And obviously there's a normal thing about not selling it to people who are not your members or season ticket holders. So that was very strict in those days. And I haven't actually, Chris, got a match ticket, but you'll be interested in another piece that I've got here. This is actually, I looked after the applications for the Palace season ticket holders in the wheelchairs, in the wheelchair section. Those that have wheelchair season tickets at Palace, these are some of the letters of people who applied for application for a ticket in that section at Villa Park. And there is the actual pass from the day, 8th of April. In 1990, one of the passes that was given out, that was part of the ticket allocations that I looked after, and that was one of the passes that was given out. So it's just little things to add to the interview. I hope you don't mind me bringing along a few items of memorabilia as well, Chris.
Got anything else?
No, not at the moment. The only other thing I've got is actually the rooming list, the details of the hotel rooming list, which I thought might be interesting. I mean, obviously, we send the rooming list through from the club secretary's office. It may well change on the day, but sent up there was Pemberton sharing a room with Alan Pardew, Mark Bright and David White, Gary O'Reilly and Nigel Martin, Sulaco and Shaw. Just a couple there that we put down. Just
people. Who's Bright in with?
David White.
Oh, yeah, you said that. Oh, sorry, I meant Wrighty.
No, he wasn't as part of the party, was he?
Of course, because he wasn't. He had his broken leg, didn't he?
Yeah, so he wasn't part of the travelling party. And then the staff that were there at that time, Steve Coppell, Ian Bramfoot, Alan Smith, Spike Hill, David West, and the kit man, Tony Carter. Even on the managerial side, obviously, and the backroom team was a lot smaller in those days. And there's a photo that's out on Twitter today showing the dugout area. Well, you can see them all in the dugout at Villa Park.
Yeah, they've got nice tracksuits on. Did you ever get one of those?
No. I'm still catching you up on the amount of Palace merchandise, but hopefully one day, there you go, another example. It's available on the online store, I'm sure. But hopefully I'll catch you up one day. But no, I didn't get one of those, no.
But you watched the game as a fan then?
Yes, I was in the stand, you see, because in those days... if it had gone to a replay, there would have been some work for the assistant secretary and club secretary to do. But obviously, thankfully, we won it on the day, so there wasn't. But and there was no media as such after the game like there is now. So it wasn't needed. And if Palace fans always know about following the club on a roller coaster, well, that afternoon certainly was. And it was an amazing afternoon. And obviously... to come back from being that early goal down from Ian Rush to being pegged back after we'd gone ahead later in the game. It was a great effort. And I remember there was I don't know if it was a fans forum or a sporting dinner, something like that, in Crystal's banqueting suite on the Thursday night before the game. And Steve Coppell and Ron Nodes were both there. And then obviously Steve was getting a lot of questions about the game the following weekend and the semi-final build-up and that. And he actually said that they'd worked on training in the week, on the plan they had. They had a plan, and he was hoping they could work that plan out and get on top in it. And I think because so many people had heard that from the manager on the night, they were just hoping that plan was going to see us through. In true Steve Coppell style, he never revealed what the plan was, but I'm sure he will tell you that the plan was to get us through to 90 minutes and then win it in extra time. So full marks to Steve for that.
Well done, Steve. And for you, how soon after the game did you have to get back to work and start planning the final?
It was a Sunday, wasn't it? So we headed back to the motorway, which was just, as I'm sure you've heard from so many people, was just a sea of red and blue. It was just tremendous. The whole M6, M1, whatever way we came back was just tremendous. It really was. The Palace fans took over the motorway that afternoon back south. And then we were back in work. On the Monday, but we obviously couldn't prepare for the final because the other replay went to the other match on the Sunday. Oldham Man United went to a replay, so their replay was on the Wednesday following, I think it was. So, yeah, and then we found out we played Man United in the final, and the arrangements for that all started again. So, yeah, it was a tremendous time at the club, and a lot of great memories for everyone associated, whether it was, you know, out on the pitch, the backroom team, the backroom staff, or for fans that had the opportunity to be there on the day. And of course, that was the first Sunday that the FA Cup semi-finals were shown live on TV. So you had the opportunity to see it, even if you couldn't get a ticket.
Brilliant. Sounds such an amazing era for the club. Thank you very much for talking to me and for bringing your memorabilia out of the archives.
No problem at all.
Enjoy it. How are you getting on with isolation?
Yeah, it's obviously it's difficult. Fortunately, I've got a garden and get out and go for a walk and that each day. But yeah, I mean, obviously the message is as clear as everyone's saying it, aren't they? Stay at home and save lives. Let's just make sure that we get through the other side and things all get back to normal as soon as humanly possible.